Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 303. And this is the last respectable episode of the Distraction Pieces podcast for 2019. For next week sees the return of the Drunk Cast, if it's releasable. You know we've recorded one Drunk Cast in the past that we then couldn't release. So we might have nothing for the rest of the year, but at the moment, the plan is to record this Sunday, the 15th. I'm sure I'll do a post to get you guys to post some questions for us while we get hammered. But this is the last proper guest of the year, and it couldn't be a better one. It's a chat I had a month or two ago with Yoni Wolf of Why and of Cloud Dead and loads of other music that I've been a huge fan of for years. And I loved this conversation. It's one that I am the nerd over because it was on a week that I had so much on. And it was a real tough one to fit it in. But I forced myself because I'm like, I've been a fan of this guy for years. And as soon as we sat down, like we discussed it afterwards, it seems mad that we've never sat down and chatted before. So I was so glad that I pushed through the exhaustion and schedule issues and made it happen. Because you're going to hear it's a really good chat. Before we get into it, I'm going to keep the intro brief. Obviously, actually, before anything else there, before I plug stuff, thank you all so much for 2019, man. This year, we took total listens to over 16 million. We broke the 300 episode mark. It's mad. And we've had just amazing reactions to some amazing guests. PC Leon McLeod this year and the Stammer special have been real emotional ones for me and real standouts. Obviously, every guest I've been so happy with this year because otherwise I don't release them or I don't have them on. But yeah, it's meant the world, so thank you so much. And thank you so much for supporting the Pod Bible, the magazine I'm part of and the podcast I'm part of. Pod Bible has had the most insanely successful first year of anything I've ever been involved in. So it's mad. If you've missed that, The podcast, they're 20-minute episodes out every Monday. You can go and listen to them, the back catalogue of them. You can smash through everything that we've done so far in a couple of hours. The reaction's been amazing, and the magazine as well, the reaction to the magazine. The most recent one has an interview with Ramesh Ranganathan, an amazing picture of him on the front cover by Dan Draws. So, yeah, thank you so much for all of that. One of the things I hadn't announced, because a lot of you have been long-time listeners will know that I've had some nightmares over the years with vinyl on my label. But I was delighted a few days ago to release the first ever vinyl pressing of my debut album, No Commercial Breaks. And that's really exciting. And it's on transparent orange vinyl. It's been flying out, so by the time this comes out, it might have sold out. But I'm hoping everyone who wants one for Christmas or has a loved one that wants one for Christmas, because it's, as I said, it's something that I've never released before. I had the original run was on CD, and I made 1,000, and it didn't have a proper barcode. So now I've done a run on vinyl. I might do more. I'm not saying that this is a one-off run, but vinyl is really expensive and takes ages to make. So if we sell out, it won't be around again for a while, but that's out now, No Commercial Breaks on vinyl for the first time. That originally came out in 2006, so pretty much 14 years on, we're dropping that vinyl for the first time. So head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com is what I'm saying there. It's where we've got hoodies, beanies, gloves, umbrellas, all sorts of shit, signed photos. What? That's weird, isn't it? But me and my mate Tom, who's done a lot of photography with me for years, we did a 10 years apart photo shoot. So we recreated two photo shoots that we did 10 years ago, and then we put them together and signed them. So they're available. All sorts of stuff. Basically, if you're a fan and want to get yourself something for Christmas, or you've got a loved one who's a fan, my Times best-selling Distraction Pieces book is available still, I think. I don't think we've sold out of that. We've sold out of Poetry and Emotion, and we won't be doing any more of that book. That's the whole run gone. There's ideas over there for Christmas presents, is what I'm telling you. SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. Fill them boots / stockings. Patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. It's there if you're interested in that kind of thing. I launched it last year with the Drunk Cast hangover. So if I get time, basically at the moment, the day after we're recording the Drunk Cast, I'm recording another podcast. And then the day after that, I'm on set with a TV show that I'm doing. And then the day after that, I'm recording two more podcasts. So I don't know if I'll get time to have a hangover, essentially. But if I do, I'll record a Drunk Cast hangover and I'll put that out after the Drunk Cast has gone up, I guess. But yeah, that's all patreon.com/ScroobiusWhip. It's only a dollar. It's no big deal. Don't get involved if you don't want to. If you do, it's there. You know, there's a year's worth of bonus podcasts and bonus spoken word pieces and stuff like that. But I ain't crazy active on there. You know, that's why it's only a dollar. Because I'm not like, here's new things every week. Fuck that. It's there, though. Anyway, me and Yoni talk about his new music, touring, artistic choices, everything. It's one of my favourite chats. I love there's a political section towards the end that questions when artists should be political, or when it's viable to be political, if it's mentally possible to be political in this day and age with the barrage of social media. But yeah, it's a wicked chat. I hope you enjoy it. I'll be back next week with the Drunk Cast. So yeah, for now, I'll be back at the end, in fact, to say goodbye and that. But for now, enjoy episode 303 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Yoni Wolf. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Drifting between the worlds of rap and spoken word.
Yeah.
All the rappers I knew would cover the mics completely.
Cup the mics,
which can be bad. But all the spoken word artists I knew would like hold it at their chest, which is equally bad. And it was I genuinely felt the reason at festivals and stuff like that, the sound guys, everyone liked us, was I would control it appropriately. I would keep it really close to my mouth. I wouldn't cover it. So it's that advantage of having that experienced booming voice.
Rare trait in the hip-hop spoken word world.
It really is. So I'm joined today by Yoni Wolf. How you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm good. There's loads I want to talk to you about. Obviously, you're on tour at the moment. As we record this, this will be coming out because you've only got a week left on the tour, right?
Yeah.
This will be coming out after the tour. But I kind of want to go all over the place because when the first Cloud Dead record came out in 2001, genuinely, I swear it was like a week or two after it came out in this country, I was getting a coach to try and live in Amsterdam, and the coach was like a 12-hour coach journey. And I bought that album, and I listened to it literally for the whole 12 hours on my CD Discman. And it was the perfect music for that. Obviously, I was going there for kind of angsty reasons to go and experience life, but also to go and try a lot of drugs and try a lot of different styles of culture, and it felt like the perfect album for that. So
and you're like 18, 19 at the time?
Or 19, 20 maybe, a little bit older, but yeah, it was perfect. How was that time for you guys? Because that did seem to kind of come out of nowhere, and it wasn't like anything else I'd ever heard.
It was a very adventurous time. I was the same age as you, similar age.
Yeah.
To you, and kind of just exploring music and seeing what it could be, and sort of stretching the idea of what hip hop was, you know, in our minds, and you know, how can we be ourselves but also make this music that we're influenced by, and marry all the different kinds of music we're interested in. And
yeah, how was that the roots were in hip hop? Because I adore hip hop, but it can be one of the most closed off genres, and
especially at that time.
Yeah, I remember at that time, kind of raving about you guys to certain friends. They'd be all over it. Other friends would be like, "It's not hip hop. It's not rap. These aren't rap kids. These are art school kids, or these kids, or that kids," and trying to exclude it from this weird pure version of hip hop that they had in their heads. So, how was that to battle?
Well, at that time, it was very fundamentalist. You know, hip-hop at large was. And we were definitely not, accepted in that world, I feel like.
Yeah.
And yet, since then, I've had so many kids, ironically, weirdly, tell me, I got into hip-hop because of your music.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, kids that never would have listened to more boom-bap stuff, like, ended up falling into Cloud Dead, and then were like, oh, well, maybe I could listen to more traditional rap. But yeah, we definitely were outside of that, and we were art school kids, but we were also hip-hop kids, you know, like, we were all that stuff. So
those things don't have to be mutually exclusive.
Exactly.
It's music. It can get anywhere. That's
exactly.
That's the beauty of it. It is an odd genre for it, though. I mean, I try not to do it myself now, because you see people who are into old school hip-hop, or even that era of 2001, 2002, you guys, your Buck 65, your Sage France, all of these, you'll see a lot of fans of that hating on mumble rap or whatever else. And for me, it's like, number one, you don't have to listen to it. But number two, it's good that any rap is getting airplay and getting listens and getting out there. It feels to me it's weird to turn on your own genre as such.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like now it's become, you know, it's gone from being this sort of, you know, almost all hip-hop felt sort of underground back in the day somehow. Yeah. You know, there were like certain things that would poke out and become mainstream. But, you know, I definitely felt like everything I listened to back then felt underground. Now, you know, it's the dominant culture.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. Hip-hop is the sort of main pop music now.
I mean, I think you nailed it with the dominant culture, because outside of music, even, hip-hop is the biggest influence on fashion, on everything, it seems.
Absolutely.
Literally, the dominant culture is what it is. There's so much from the development of language, from terms and phraseology and all this kind of thing. It's all... There's so much that's come from this underground, hidden away world.
Absolutely. I mean, look at like internet slang or, you know, like all that stuff. Lots of that stuff comes from hip hop. Yeah. Yeah. No, it has gone that route. And so now I feel like, you know, if we were to do the Cloud Dead thing, you know, that we did in, you know, 2000, 2001, now I feel like it would be more accepted as like, okay, this is just part of the wide swath of what hip-hop is. But I felt like back then it was a lot more closed off.
Do you think that's why you guys kind of started Anticon, to give a home to the homeless as such? Because you said you didn't feel like you were embraced by that scene. And Anticon, with people like Buck and Sage Francis early on, and Beans, Serengeti going forward, there's so many artists that don't necessarily all fit on a record together, or can, but I mean, there's differences, but the common difference is you're not the other. You're not that version of hip-hop.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Was that what kind of made that?
I mean, as far as I know, like, I wasn't, like, involved in all, like, the sort of inner decision-making in terms of, like, the big boy shit in the beginning. I was sitting at the children's table, you know, making the music that they were wheeling and dealing, but as far as, like, the management stuff, that wasn't me. But as far as I understand it, we decided to do that because we weren't able to get record deals elsewhere. You know, like, I think these guys were trying to get record deals. I'm talking like Soul and Dose, you know, those guys like had tried to get record deals with majors and indies and stuff, and were just laughed out of the offices. And they were like, all right, fuck it. Let's make our own label. And that's kind of how it started, yeah.
So how was that in those early days? Because the label started, but as you say, it was like seven of you, I think, originally were seen as the label people, the originators. And as you said there, you weren't really on the management part of it. How was that? How was the mix of all of that to be, here's all of us are the label, but these are the artists and these are the behind-the-scenes guys and so on and so forth?
Yeah, it was kind of, I mean, I feel like it was like Soul and Dose in the beginning that were just kind of like, all right, we've got to do this. And then they just were kind of pushing on things and, you know, let's find a distributor. Let's find it, you know, all the different things that you need to be a label. And they sort of did that stuff. But, you know, under the guise of like, oh, by the way, distributor, you know, we've got maybe, you know, 12 other artists that we're working with and different, you know. But yeah, then we decided at some point, like, all right, let's make it like a business. That's when like, it was like, all right, seven of us are on the board of the, or eight of us or whatever it was on the board of the business and blah, blah, and
How long
did that stay enjoyable and fun, and how quickly did, because as soon as it becomes the business side of things, that's when shit starts to get a bit weird. And
shit got weird. Shit was weird from the get-go. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, there were always internal weirdnesses and sort of disagreements and disparities between, or just different ideas of what the thing should be, basically.
But it seemed to work, and it seemed to build. Like, it felt like Anti-Con almost became a genre rather than just a label. Yeah. It felt like it was this own, oh, that's Anti-Con kind of music. I remember when on my second single, we got a remix by Gel, and I was buzzing because of the Anti-Con connection, because just before I'd started, that was the stuff that I was going, oh, wow, this isn't like anything I've heard before. And, yeah, it kind of, it felt like at that time it became a genre more than a label.
I think that was really cool. I think we liked that, but that wasn't really the intended outcome. You know what I mean? We had different ideas. Like some people in the sort of like in the 7-8 or whatever had this idea of it being like this Wu-Tang thing where it's like, okay, I remember there was always talk back then, like, we need to make a posse record. We need to make a posse record, you know, and it never really happened. There were a couple records that were like, compilations, you know,
but that's
different, you know, but like there was all this talk and we made a few like posse cuts or whatever back in the day, but by and large, you know, I was on the other side where it's like, I just want to make my, you know, I'm an auteur. I just want to make my music, you know? Yeah. And, you know, but I would do a song here and there with the gang and everything. But yeah, I definitely the outside, especially over here in England and in Europe, I feel like there was this feeling that like it was almost like you said, a genre or like, you know, its own like division of hip hop or something. Yeah.
So, I mean, just speaking of kind of the idea of, and again, it's a natural thing. Whenever there's a collective, people want everyone together. And I always remember the excitement at the Deep Puddle Dynamics stuff coming out and it being kind of collaborative. And it comes to mind because one of the things I wanted to talk about, even if it's briefly, is Alias. I only met him once or twice, but I work a lot. I'm very close with B. Dolan, who was very close with Alias. And we lost him a little while back. But yeah, how important was he as a kind of behind-the-scenes guy for making the sound of so much of the people that are at the front, if you know what I mean? You think of these rappers that have, or even a kind of Anti-Con sound, a lot of that behind-the-scenes was Alias and Joe and people like that.
Absolutely. I would say like the Anti-Con sound, you know, of that, all that early era was Alias, Joe, Nostom, you know, DJ Mayonnaise. Yeah, these are the guys. And especially Alias. Like, I feel like he was like a workhorse.
Yeah.
All through the, you know, up through like the first decade of the 2000s. Just churning out stuff for a lot of different people, you know, making beats for not just the people, you know, like Soul and people sort of within the collective, but externally too.
Yeah.
If you considered Sage and B. Dolan, I mean, you know, they weren't owners, but certainly we fucked with those guys.
Yeah.
So no, I mean, it's a huge loss. It's a huge loss. And, he just always felt like to me to be the sort of stable, logical, like there was a lot of insanity going on within the collective. Yeah. And he was not that at all. He was like, all right, I'm a dude that works hard. I'm, you know, I know what I like. I make what I like.
Yeah.
I fuck with who I like to fuck with. Like, that was him. And
he felt like that foundation of a guy in that way. And again, as you kind of said about when things were blowing up and you're like, I'm just an artist, I just want to make my music. He was that dude. He was very much, particularly when Dibs comes to mind, as someone who could then tour and be a producer, but his own as a DJ and this whole live thing. It felt like Alias, if he'd wanted, could have said, I want to be on the road, I want to do this, I want to do that. It's like, I just want to make this music, I want to make these beats.
He did that for like a little while, and he hated it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I never really talked to him that much about it until I also have a podcast. I interviewed him on my podcast, like, I want to say it was like 2016 or 2015 or something like that. And, he was pretty clear about that. He hated Torn.
I love it. I released a blues artist on my record label called Giacomo Brown. And one of the things I loved about his story was he played live twice mm-hmm. and didn't see the appeal. He literally, he tried it once, was like, oh, I don't like this. He tried it again just to make sure. Was like, nah, I don't see the appeal. I just want to make this music. I ain't about that. Particularly in a world where it's so built to we want to be rock stars and touring musicians.
I've been doing it for like 18 years. And I agree with Giacomo 100%, but I don't know how to. I'm stuck.
Yeah,
I have no idea how to move forward without the touring. But I'm working on it.
It's the traditional route in the business, isn't it? I guess that
it is.
And again, it's flipped over the years where you used to. I swear, my outlook on the music industry is you used to tour to promote a record. And then the money came out of records and people started releasing a record to promote a tour. And now we're in this kind of middle ground where it's like, well, we're just touring.
100%.
There isn't always a record involved. It's just, this is just the job now. It's
100%. Or actually, even I'll go beyond that and say people are making records so that they can tour.
Yeah.
You know, which is crazy. But yeah, that's...
I need a reason to get people out for this latest tour.
Exactly. Here's a record. So that's the difference between the beginning of my career and where I'm at now, which we could call, quote unquote, the end of my career, is that, in the beginning, it was definitely like, you like the record is the important thing. Like you're writing music. Need to get this out there. I'm making an important statement. And then I'll do some touring to support the ideas that I've made. Now it's like I need to have some way to sell tickets to a show. I mean, say what you will. Maybe I can't make a judgment on whether one's worse or better than the other, but it is what it is.
It's a weird world as well, because I think your stuff with Why, it was always confusing because it's Why the person or the band, but then it became the band. But your stuff as Why, it's kind of it's felt like you've played that long game and built up a loyal audience who really give a shit and are really big fans. But people don't realise that can at times be tough as a touring artist, because it means you're not having that, here's our moment this year, here's the reason. People will just be, oh, I'll catch them if I can,
right?
But not necessarily, I need to catch every show, if you know what I mean. So it's quite a weird one. You build that loyal audience, which is the dream. That's what you want, rather than this flash in the pan moment. But it also means it's hard to make that spark and that excitement.
We're still waiting for our moment.
Yeah,
we're still waiting for our moment, dude.
Yeah.
No. I mean, you're absolutely right, and I do feel very blessed. You know, I'm very grateful that we do have this hyper loyal audience. But like you said, they're loyal, and like, you know, we've, you know, impacted their lives, and I get messages all the time. Yeah. Gosh, you know, your music got me through this time in my life or that time in my life. And that's incredible. And just to have been able to have, you know, to touch people's lives like that and to whatever impact the world on that small scale is really cool. But yeah, you're right. Like when we go out, it's always a guessing game. Are people going to come to the shows or not? And like, you know, we had our biggest tour ever in terms of turnouts, like 8 months ago, 9 months ago or something like that, when we did like a reissue tour on a 10-year-old album that, like, you know, had like gotten very popular over the last 10 years, you know? And so everybody came out to see that, which was awesome. And then, you know, now we're on another new record, which is like, the record's actually selling really well as far as how records sell now, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, the shows are pretty small because people are like, oh yeah, I went and saw that last year, you know what I mean? And they sort of got the Why bug out 8 months ago and then they're not going to come back right away. So, you know, you got to give them some time.
Of a nostalgia injection as well.
The nostalgia.
It's a mad drug. I've been thinking about it a lot recently because films, TV, music, so much seems to rely on nostalgia now. And again, from the artist point of view, that can be annoying. From the human point of view, I can understand it because it's a beautiful and warm and nice thing. It's that album that you've known for 10 years rather than for 10 weeks.
Yeah.
There's something in that.
Also, there's something about the thing that you discovered when you were 16, 17 years old.
100%.
Like, that, like, you always will have this feeling about. And that's that record for those people.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's an interesting one because a lot of people in music in particular, particularly if you're slightly left field, will bang on and on about being underrated. And I always find that a really disrespectful term because, as an example, I've got certain mates who, you being on this podcast, is the most excited they've been for any podcast because underrated kind of discredits those who have that connection, as you said, who have those songs that mean the world, who send you those messages that say, this literally changed my life, or are coming to the shows and paying so much attention and understanding every little improvisation and little change that you and the band might know, but most of the crowd aren't going to kind of realise, but the stuff that you're buzzing off, they're buzzing off. And that means the world. Again, it's tough because it might not mean the world financially,
right.
because it doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting these stadium tours, but right. it means
the world to a very small amount of people,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
but I don't look past that, you know what yeah. I mean? That's a really awesome thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was your route into music and into hip hop? I was reading about you born into a Masonic, a Jewish family and finding your dad's four track.
Yeah.
How did that all come about? What was the process?
Yeah, I guess that's a story that's probably, I don't know. Yeah, it's probably in my bio or something.
Yeah.
where when I was like 13, I remember being at my dad's synagogue. He's a preacher, Messianic rabbi, which is like Messianic Judaism is a unique cross between pretty traditional Judaism and evangelical Christianity, you know,
yeah.
So speaking in tongues and stuff like
that.
So.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I grew up. Ended up there one afternoon. I don't know. I think I probably got off school and then went over there. And, yeah, was just, like, digging through this closet, and there was a four-track. My dad showed me how to use it. And it just was, like, a real, you know, the light sort of clicked on. Just the idea of layering, you know, of recording and kind of layering one sound and then another sound. And it was like, whoa. And then you can listen to them together. Just really was cool to me. And then I didn't really mess with that again all throughout high school. But I was listening to a lot of hip hop in high school and sort of started rapping alone in my bedroom, you know.
Yeah.
I
know it well.
Yeah, yeah. And then after high school, the summer after high school, I was in this program, like this like city-funded program called Artworks, where I joined the performance tent of this organization, and our task was to go around to like community centers and old folks' homes and stuff like that and perform for the people there. And during my audition for this thing, you know, they asked, okay, well, can you play any instruments? And I said, well, yeah, I play drums. So they gave me like a bongo and said, okay, play a beat on here or whatever. And I did that. And they were like, okay, you got good rhythm. Good, good, good. Do you do anything else? And I said, well, I rap. You what? I rap. I'm a rapper, you know, but like I had never done it in public. So they had me do that in the audition and they're like, okay, all right. And then, so that's the role they gave me in this performance thing. It was me and this girl, Walia, and I was like this little tiny white guy, Jewish guy, and she was like 6'5" black girl, and we were the duo. We were the rap duo.
Amazing.
Of the group. So we would go, and the rest of the team would all be playing hand drums and sort of traditional African percussion instruments that we had made throughout our tenure in the program, and her and I wrote our raps about unity and you know, all things positive and peace, world peace and stuff. So we did that summer, and then I went to a festival that I had been going to for the 3 or 4 years prior as a graffiti artist, which I was already a graffiti artist in high school, called Scribble Jam.
To get the DVDs imported in. I love Scribble Jam. Yeah.
So that was in Cincinnati. That took place in Cincinnati where I grew up. And we started going, me and my friends, because we were like the toy graffiti artists and like the main crew,
mm-hmm.
TSC, had this thing called Scribble Jam. And they owned Scribble Magazine, which was a graffiti magazine.
Yeah.
So I went to Scribble Jam 97, and that is where I first saw Dos One.
Yeah.
Okay. And he was in the rap battles, and as was Eminem.
I was going to say, yeah. I remember on one of the later DVDs, they'd converted a load of the tapes, and it blew my mind because Dos One, who I'd fallen in love with from the Cloud Dead stuff, was in there against Eminem, who at that point was the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Like, these felt like two different worlds. And it's like,
totally. But man, you know what?
It's mad that this was together at any point.
What's crazy is that they were in the same world at that time. Yeah. They were both underground.
Yeah.
You know, rugged, like camo pants wearing.
Yeah.
You know, Timberland boots wearing guys that were influenced by, I don't know, whatever. I'm not going to say who they were.
Yeah.
But like, they were coming from the same world.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
And they just sort of, that was like the one point where they met, and then they split off.
A fork in the road that couldn't, yeah, couldn't make them more different, but at right. that moment.
But at that time, seeing Dos at that Scribble Jam thing, he could have gone the Eminem route.
Yeah.
Instead, he met me and had a lukewarm career in music. no, but I don't think he regrets anything. He, you no, know, because he, cool. you know, he went for it and was his and is always his truest self.
Yeah.
And you know, you can never regret that.
First guy I ever saw at a rap festival absolutely smash his solo set with a huge pink scarf on.
Yes.
I was like, well, there you go. This is the guy I want to get behind. This
yes.
is well, everyone else is in hoodies and kind of big jackets and bobbing slightly. He was yep. there, big pink scarf, doing NPC stuff and then rapping and then looping and DJing and all of
yeah, I felt like he quickly, you know, once he was like, okay, I'm going to do my own thing and like fuck all this bravado stuff, he quickly like took the bravado to that whole other direction. Yeah. It was like, fuck you, I'm wearing a pink scarf. Like,
fuck all this bravado stuff.
Yeah.
This bravado stuff yeah. I'm bringing to the next level.
The pink scarf bravado. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it sounds interesting to hear of your kind of upbringing there, because particularly the Masonic Judaism had kind of a rhythmic nature in some of the preaching, had chanting, had and it, you kind of hear that in those early records, the layering of vocals, the repetition, the chanting. Do you think that influenced it all, kind of taking your musical cues as much from the synagogue as from the mixtape that's come out that week?
I would say that definitely sort of that Cantor shit
yeah.
influenced my rap style like a lot. Yeah.
yeah.
That's why I, you know, from the get-go pretty much I had melodies in my raps and, you know, you know, like,
that was so rare at that point. Really, at that point, yeah. it felt like everyone was just, you're trying to spit as hard as you can.
Right,
let's go. Whereas this was, it's what blew me away with Cloud Dead was all of you guys kind of just going up and down all over the place. And it was even if you took the music off, it had a musicality and it had a melody, as you say.
Yeah, yeah. It felt like a natural way to go for us, and yeah.
How was it moving into rap from that family background? How was it embraced? How was it looked upon by your family?
You know, both my parents are artists in one way or another. My dad like always wrote songs, and you know now he like has written 3 books and like novels and made some movies. You know, so you know he completely understood that. My mom is a visual artist, a painter. So, like, yeah, honestly, they didn't bat an eye. You know, that's I great, mean, yeah. there's some content that they certainly batted yeah. an eye about.
Yeah.
But the idea of me being an artist or pursuing, you know, music as a lifestyle or whatever didn't really bother them at all. And still, they're fine with it. And my dad is proud to say that his kids are semi-successful musicians, you know.
I love it. So how was the kind of transition after Cloud Dead into doing expanding what Wire was and solo stuff? Because you were originally doing hip-hop that was outside of the hip-hop, main hip-hop realm, and now you're kind of drifting into indie or electronic or guitar-based music that's maybe outside of the most pop version of that as well. So how was that as a kind of a journey? Because it's not like you went from one thing to a completely pop version commercial crossover. You went from one left-field area to another left-field area to in between two left-field areas.
Can't seem to make it easy for myself, exactly, no matter what I right. do. Yeah, I mean, all I know is, you know, for the first, like, three Y albums, we had to put a sticker on it that said, please file under rock. Yeah. You know, because everyone knew Anacon, oh, hip-hop, Anacon. So it would just go in the hip-hop sections and then, like, it would get ignored. So it would be like, oh, we got to have, please cross-file under hip-hop and rock or whatever, you know. Yeah, it was, it always felt like an uphill battle to, like, you know, expose people. But no, I felt like I want people to hear it that aren't necessarily hip-hop heads.
Yeah.
You know, because I feel like there are other people that would like it too. But it was always hard to crack over. You know, I was trying to cross over from hip-hop to rock, I guess, or indie rock or whatever. But that was always a struggle. But eventually, we just kept doing it. We kept touring, kept putting out records, and we sort of got an audience of our own that didn't even necessarily know or had ever heard of what Anticon was. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, completely.
So we just sort of became our own thing after a while.
Yeah, I always remember I saw you guys on an early, I'm sure it was in Shoreditch somewhere. I think it was at a venue called Spitz, which was like on Spitalfields Market, and it was more of a jazz venue, and it was exciting for me to kind of go, all right, so what's going on here? So did you find that touring changed in that way, that you're going from what might be perceived as a traditional rap venue, small stage or whatever else, to these more jazz venues, more unusual?
I can't say that really changed the touring at all. I almost feel like, you know, it was always just the promoters and booking agents trying to find a place that would take us and
that fit,
that wasn't too expensive, and then, you know, pretty just standard thing, and just standard rock clubs and bars, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I can't say, like, we've done a couple, like, little special occasion tours where it's like, you know, grand piano, fancy place kind of thing,
but
mostly we've always just toured in typical dirty rock clubs, which I don't love, but is what it is.
I mean, speaking of that, then, of touring at any level that's below the Rolling Stones, you know, you're not in these tour vans, you're not in this, you've got to make it work. A friend of mine, a Jimmy Havoc, this is going to sound like a strange a leap, he's a professional wrestler, he's really good, but he's had to do that professional wrestler life with Crohn's, and it's something that you would never know about, but all the different things it adds to how he has to tour, to how he has to manage his dietary requirements, his everything else. It's a massive change, and you've had to kind of deal with that touring your whole life, right?
Absolutely. You know, I didn't know I had Crohn's until 2009.
Right.
But I had problems before that, and even before that, I was like very, very, very strict vegan.
Yeah.
So like that in and of itself, and my personality is like all or nothing.
Yeah.
So, like, I never cheated. You know what I mean? Like, it was like, all right. So, like,
I need to put a caveat in here. I mean, we've talked about the troubles of getting your CD filed in the right place in a record store, which is already harking back to a previous time of music because of record stores in general. But veganism now compared to veganism in the early 2000s,
different.
It's not the same thing.
It's not
comparable. So,
no,
again, this struggle is far bigger than it may sound at this.
I got in so many fights with so many French chefs in the festival backstages.
That's
the
perfect example.
It is not possible.
Yeah, like, they will not understand it or accept
it. Just some tofu, please, or whatever, you know. that was always a struggle to try to find. You know, and honestly, now when I think back, I regret not, like, living it up and, like, going to Japan and eating, like, whatever food that they put in front of me, you know, rather than saying, like, I'll just have the rice, you know, whatever. But yeah, it was tough back then. But then, of course, I got sick and then had to really change it up. And now I cook every 3-4 days.
Right.
Carry around Tupperware with food in it. And, you know, have a bag of dry goods that will last, you know, whatever, fruits and veggies and rice cakes, you know what I mean? And just kind of bring my own food everywhere and eat out of that.
It's a case of another thing that you have to be prepared about on a tour, it's rather a than just the
hassle.
Kind of
it's a
turn
hassle.
Up and see what's about.
Yeah, it turns touring into a very, like, an endeavor that you really have to prepare for and really have to, like, consider. Yeah.
Yeah, so can we just, just for anyone who doesn't know, can you explain Crohn's a little bit? So it is a dietary thing. There's certain things that you eat that you react badly to and are very dangerous for you, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it is diet, but it goes beyond that. Like, you can't, I mean, anyway, some people might be able to control it with diet, but I have pretty severe disease that I can't control with diet, but I can lessen the effects with diet.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's, you know, it can be really tough. It's basically becomes inflammation in your anywhere in your digestive tract, I guess. Yeah. Mine is more in my small intestines, and that then becomes ulcers.
Yeah.
And just like basically just rotting and, you know, rotting flesh in your body.
Yeah.
That then you have to get cut out, which I did in June.
Wow.
Got some intestines cut out. But yeah, it's tough, and it's tough at home, but it's real tough on the road.
Yeah, it makes a massive difference. Now you've been lucky enough to tour the world, like literally the world, and I think that's one of the cool things about not necessarily fitting into one genre, is that you can appeal to far more nations and things like that. Just really have this wider appeal rather than you're a big hip hop act and you just do America and the UK. Canada, you get to go about a lot. So how do you find that? Do you take a lot from the cultures and areas? I mean, you're in the UK at a really interesting time politically. There's a lot going on with Brexit. I mean, it's hardly worth us mentioning Brexit here because it will have changed by tomorrow. It was all going to be, as we recalled this, it was all going to be happening in 2 days. Now it's going to be happening at the end of January. And there's going to be elections and all that. Do you immerse yourself in any of these things in these countries, or are you kind of just in tour mode? Let's get through it.
I would say mostly I'm in tour mode. Let's get through it.
Yeah.
But, you know, also you can't ignore what's going on around you, especially when it, and it sounds terrible for me to say I'm just in tour mode getting through it. But like, that's the blinders that my life has to have in order to get through. You know, you're not really in that place. You're on tour.
Yeah.
You know what
I'm
saying? You're there, but you're there under the auspices of getting to the next venue performing and then getting to the next venue, you know?
Yeah.
So but I will say that we really lucked out because we had set this tour up before we knew when Brexit was going to happen.
Yeah.
And it turned out that it was going to happen the day that we were going to try to go from the UK to Europe.
Yeah.
So the 31st was our travel day.
Literally inconceivable problems. Like, you don't know how that could have gone.
And that would have been fucked. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you can only assume that there is going to be some crazy travel situations on that day. But lucky for us, it got postponed.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll stay postponed. You know, who knows what'll happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, you talk to people so you know a little bit about what's going on. But by and large, we're at the hotel. We're at the venue. We're sound checking. We're playing. We're packing up. We're at the hotel.
Yeah.
Repeat. You know what I mean?
Have you found any difference in the reaction as an American touring over the years? Because you've toured as an American under Bush. You've toured as an American under Obama. You're touring as an American under Trump.
Yeah.
There's going to be a difference in perceptions over those years, right? How do you find that? And does it is it something that is tactile or you can kind of notice, or is it just kind of, more ethereal?
I feel like during Bush, there was honestly more hatred of America around the world because he felt more integrated into America. Obama, when Obama got elected, we were here, actually.
Wow.
And England seemed ecstatic when Obama got. I just remember that morning, you know, we woke up and we were traveling actually from London to Brussels, I think it was. And just the guys at the border, and like, you know, when you start talking to them and they hear your American accent, like, oh, Obama, you know. So there was a lot of people liked him on the world stage, you know, they really did.
I was touring in America when that was when the debates were going on, and we didn't particularly have televised debates over at that point. So to see someone as calm and eloquent as Obama up there, just destroying everyone, essentially just being like, my favorite character ever is Omar from The Wire, and just like, this is the best guy in the world ever, and then he'll shoot some basketball or something, like, how is this guy not king of the world? Obviously, there's varying views on his time as president and some of the choices. But
people did like him on the world stage. Yeah, he did some bad stuff for sure. But any world leader does bad. You're sort of required to do some bad things to make break a few eggs to keep the whatever.
Yeah, I think it's the problem that we've made these mythical roles as if president is an all powerful thing, and there's not loads of people who have to put pressure on or sign things off, or it's not just one person in the chair going.
He's not the Pope.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not a king. It's not a medieval type thing. Yeah. I mean, like we have in England, it's not a medieval type structure like that. Yeah. So yeah,
but as far as Trump goes, I get the feeling that no one's faulting. I don't think anyone faults anyone who travels.
Yeah,
for Trump getting elected, I don't think anyone who travels outside the United States voted for Trump. The like 12 like billionaires that are his friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think the world understands that the United States doesn't stand behind him, you know, and never did. But it was some weird fluke and sort of not a fluke. I should you know, there's some hateful shit.
Yeah.
That is at the root of that, and at the root of what makes America America, you know.
Yeah. I think it's going to be an interesting one after the next election.
Oh my God,
because at this point, you can kind of say it was not a fluke, but a weird perfect storm or an imperfect storm that just made all these things happen. That suddenly Trump's the president of America. It's like again, I'm convinced that 2016. It wasn't real because Prince died, Trump became president, Brexit happened. All these things that are just unimaginable. It's like that's nonsense. That can't be a thing. But
there's a whole another set of people that are saying that about 2008 or whatever.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's those.
There's
it's
good
those,
people in this world, and there's bad people.
Yeah. The perfect according to us is subjective in its perfection.
Exactly.
You're quite understandably in tour mode when you tour. You got kind of drawn in unavoidably to some political side of things with Meteor Festival last year, with the Israeli-Palestine conflict and being a Jewish touring musician. How was that to kind of have your art brought into kind of a political discussion and political decisions to be made and justified when you're an artist and you're touring doing a music, you're not touring doing politics?
Yeah, you're right. I don't initially think of myself as a political artist. You know, I'm as political as I need to be to inform myself and make a vote, basically. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I'm not really, I wouldn't call myself an activist. You know, I don't follow every little, like, you know, like part of the political world, like people do sports teams and politics. Not my thing. But, you know, something as serious and like contemporary and really happening, you know, as Israel Palestine, and being invited to go over there and deciding to do it despite some people saying, oh, well, if you care about Palestine, you wouldn't go there. You know, you have to inform yourself, and you have to have some, you know, you have to say something.
Yeah.
You have to say something. So I did do that at the festival, and you know, I don't regret going. I don't feel like us going showed any kind of support for the Israeli government.
Yeah.
I felt like, if anything, the big article in the biggest paper in Israel, like liberal paper, I guess, was probably made more of a positive impact than a negative impact for us to have gone over there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't regret it at all.
I think it's at times it's the broad strokes that we can make, and we can forget that you're going, as you said about how most touring American bands didn't vote for Trump and don't support Trump. It's a similar thing there, that the people that are coming to see you at that festival are probably the people who are the liberals and are against this kind of the actions that's going on and against their government. And it's completely arguable that it's a positive thing to go and perform for them and support the ability to be on that side of it, and not just, rather than we think of the Israeli government representing all of the Israeli people. It's like, no,
exactly.
It's a varied thing like anywhere else.
Exactly. And I on stage, I dedicated the set to the villages that were formerly in the location of the festival. You know, I had done all this research. My uncle is, I don't know how to describe him. He used to work for, he worked in the Obama administration. He was the, like, representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, you know, under the Secretary of State when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. So, like, he's very, very knowledgeable about that whole region and really the whole world. But I spoke to him. I said, is it okay if I go? You know, what do you think about this? Blah, 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 blah. And we talked about it. He put me in touch with some Palestinian professors in Palestine, and I spoke to them, and I said, what villages used to be around here? What's the history of this area? Blah, 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 blah. They explained all that to me. You know, I sort of learned the names of the villages and sort of, I dedicated the show to those people, and their descendants, and who some of them were still around, and the whole audience cheered, you know. So like, it's not like we're over there supporting, you know, saying, okay, our presence as American musicians here, you know, is to support your decision to be a complete dick to Palestine.
Yeah.
You know, quite the opposite. So you know,
and that feels that much of research and in-depth kind of interaction with the issues feels far more impactful than just not going.
Exactly.
Do you know,
exactly.
If not going, it wouldn't have been a news story.
Exactly.
They can't write a news story about everyone who's not gone to Israel. That's a lot of it.
So, exactly. So yeah. I said, I want to go. You know, we've got it already set up. We're friends with the promoter of the festival. We've gone out there several times. We have an audience there. They're good people. They're not the supporters of by and large. I mean, obviously I'm sure there are some, but by and large, not the supporters of the occupation. But if I'm going to go, I can't go in ignorant. You know what I mean? Like, I had to do some research and make sure that I was making the right decision. And I decided that I was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. So, I mean, with, touched upon the changes in the music industry, and again, it was amusing to me that it took me a few minutes to realize that our discussion about where a CD is filed in a record shop, there's going to be certain people who don't connect to that. I worked in record shops, I've got a huge connection to all that. But at the latest record you released in chunks as kind of audio accompaniments for or soundtracks. What's been the motivation behind the way you're approaching this record and the way it's kind of all come together, like release-wise?
Yeah, I guess initially I felt sort of like I needed a break from the idea of just from doing it exactly how I had been doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, all right, I need to change it up, shake it up. And so I wanted to actually, rather than like holding on to all this material and being all secretive and being like, okay, world, here is my opus. You know, I wanted to just be like, all right, I finished a thing. Here it is. Check it out. If you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't. Yeah. Here's another thing. Check it out. You know, and so I set up a schedule for myself. I said, okay, I'm going to finish 5 minutes of music a month, mixed, mastered, done, and put it out. And so I started doing that, made my first 5 minutes, and talked to my manager, talked to the label, and they were like, whoa, 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 wait a second, wait a second, wait a second. No, 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 no. You've got to,
yeah,
we can do that, sort of, but we want to do it properly.
Yeah.
You know, like, so yeah. I had to kind of, you know, temper my idea a little bit. But I continued to work that way anyway, yeah, even though the music didn't come out,
yeah,
right then. But it came out a year later as if it had been done right then.
Yeah. It's a good balance and a good compromise.
Yeah, because I think
the ludicrousness of the music industry got to the point, and I would have been involved in this, where you're getting pushed to announce an announcement that, like, on Monday we're going to be announcing something. It's like, what it's are ridiculous. We doing? Why don't we announce on Monday we're going to be announcing when we're announcing the next thing? It's like, it becomes this so contrived because of that idea of that you need to get all this focus on one day so that we have the biggest impact and then it can climb to its biggest chart position or whatever. And the biggest thing for me was realizing, all right, that's for chart type music.
Right.
I'm not a chart type artist.
Exactly.
So it doesn't matter so much. I get it, and I get the pooling of the excitement and you wanting everyone in it at once. But equally with that approach, you're kind of toiling away in the dark for a year. And then you finally release it, and everyone's excited. But then a week later, they've moved on to something else.
Exactly.
It's the kind of the Netflix way of TV shows, how previously you'd be watching one a week for 2 months, whereas now it comes out in one weekend, everyone's hugely excited, but then they've binged it all in 2 days,
yep,
and they've spent 2 years making this series, and the hype's over. So did you notice a difference in the kind of a drip releasing of the record to spread it out over a period of time, or was it just
not really? I mean, I honestly, it's the same kind of thing where it's like, you know, people paid attention to the first, you know, the first installment that came out,
yeah,
and the second one to some extent, and then it was like, oh, okay, there's more music coming out by these guys, it's whatever, you know, like, I honestly, you know, I sort of understand all that stuff and how it works, but it's completely on its head compared to what it was when I first started.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying like I'm some kind of like ancient Luddite or something. I use the internet.
Yeah.
But it's so mysterious how something goes or doesn't go.
Yeah.
And why I wanted to like work in the way that I was saying and just kind of put it out as I put it out is because I'm sick of it. Like, I don't, yeah, like, it's like, I don't know. Let's just be regular people and just make stuff and put it like just all this, like,
more,
all this marketing and just like hyper capitalist shit, like,
yeah,
it's for the birds, man. And we are at the end of this, like, it can't go too much further with the pooling of wealth and stuff like that.
It can't, and I think it sets you up for disappointment as well. A big thing that I was kind of adamant about when I set up my record label was that I want the end goal to be the release date. After that, cool, it's a bonus. But I want the achievement to be, yeah, we've got the artwork how we want it, we've got this how we want it, and there it is. It's out,
yep,
there. Not worrying about how are week one sales, and how's, right, week two, and how are we doing on this and that. It's like, no, all of that is a bonus. The goal is that when we release it, everyone involved is going, we fucking did it, man.
Yeah.
It's there. It's happened.
Yeah.
And I think if you can find a way to artistically or creatively make that for yourself, then you've got that achievement, rather than your constant, even if it's your biggest record of all time, it's not as big as this guy who you toured with once. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there's a comparison, and therefore they're doing better, and you failed. Do you know what I mean? There becomes all these stupid things. So
yeah,
you need to make that kind of the releasing. It is the creating and releasing is the end goal, not the
absolutely
position.
Absolutely. And I mean like, you know, the social media stuff, like I'm not very good at that stuff. Like I'm on those things, but like I'm not one of these like everyday poster you know, like I don't know how to maximize my impact on social media. Like I don't want to, you know what I mean? Like, so I don't know, man, that shit, it's outside of what I signed up to do. Like I signed up to make art, and that's what I like doing. I don't really like doing that other shit.
I love it. How have you found doing a podcast? So you've got a podcast, The Wandering Wolf, and you've been doing that a while now. Yeah. How have you found that? Sitting down and having conversations with people in a format that you might not normally.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. I love it. Being able to meet somebody like you that I've known about for so many years, and just that we've never come across. Yeah. You know, as far as I know, we've never come across
each other. I was texting some people last night because I'm sure I did some spoken word before a Y show in London once.
Okay, but maybe we did.
But I might have just gone to a Y show and I did spoken word at that same venue a different time. Gotcha. It's a blurred memory.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I was kind of texting saying, did this happen? I don't know, but I think it might have. But yeah,
it's possible, but
that known interaction.
So yeah, I mean, just to be able to sit down and talk for an hour or two, like, it's awesome, man. And because like, there, you know, everybody, I don't know, we all are in a similar world and doing, you know, doing similar stuff, and just to, you know, to be able to connect is great. And I you know, and or people that are in a totally different world, I like to just be able to pick their brain, you know, what are you about, you know, like
have you found you've learnt stuff about people, you know, that you wouldn't, because it's one of the biggest things I've found on doing the podcast is I realized that when you catch up with friends, you generally say, you talk about how the last week has been or how the last month. You don't talk about their upbringing or their tough times in life. Whereas in a podcast format, it becomes more viable and manageable, and you get to learn these things about these people who you've maybe toured with or at least spent a load of time with that you've never had anything below that initial surface of conversation.
Absolutely. I've done podcasts with my mom and my dad and my sister and my brother.
I've done them with my mom and dad as well.
Right?
I mean, they're some of my favorite ones.
There's something about that where you know, because it's the intentionality of sitting down and saying, we're not going to do anything. We're not eating.
Yeah.
You know, we're not whatever, bullshitting. We're just going to get straight to it and talk about life and talk about, you know, where you've been. And it's really great. I do learn something from every single podcast I do, and you know, have some kind of takeaway that I can integrate into my life.
It is its own art form and medium. Just mentioning speaking to parents, for years as a musician I tried to write a song about when my parents separated, and I could never find it, could never get it right. And then I spoke to them both separately on the podcast about it, and we'd never really done it. And I found that was the medium I was looking for. It wasn't meant to be a song.
Right.
It was meant to be, and me and my dad cried because that was the first, it's the first time I'd seen him cry as a kid. Like, my dad as this, the father, was the first time I'd seen him cry because he had to come and say, I'm leaving. And yeah, it was amazing. It was that beautiful moment of realization of, right, oh, these aren't just conversations. It's its own art form. It's got its own... It's a medium that is as valid as writing a song or performing a song.
Absolutely.
Or whatever else.
And honestly, there's something I prefer about it. You know, there's something more immediate. There's something more, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like there's something more relevant about it.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a truth in it.
Yeah.
One of the things that comes up a lot in my podcast, and it seems to be any podcast that has artists on, is mental health. And you recorded a track for World Mental Health Day. Was it last year or was it?
No, it was just a couple weeks ago.
Yes,
yeah,
a cover of Silver Jews. What drew you to that, and what was the impetus on bringing focus to mental health? Because again, I think in touring life and in musician life, it can be easy to get into a bubble of here's the art and not looking anywhere past that. So it can be a exposing thing to go, look, let's talk about mental health and talk about people struggling and how hard it can be.
Well, I didn't make the track thinking about, oh, we'll put this out on Mental Health Day and blah, blah, blah. It wasn't like that. It was, you know, so the track is We Are Real by the band Silver Jews.
Yes.
And the songwriter from Silver Jews, David Berman.
Yes.
He died about, I don't want to say 2 months ago. And it had a big impact on me, you know what I mean? And I don't know what he was going through in his life exactly, but I know he had struggled with addiction and probably other mental health issues, and he committed suicide. And, like, it impacted me a lot. You know, like, I always looked up to him. You know, I was greatly influenced by him, you know, in my lyrics and stuff. And it was a big blow, and I just felt off for like a long time, you know, because of that. Even though he wasn't like a close friend or anything. Mm-hmm. I knew him, but not really, you know, like I knew him to speak to him, but I didn't know him intimately whatsoever. And I don't know. I just didn't know what to do with myself. So I was like, all right, I'm going to like, I'd been like listening to all his work and stuff. And I was like, all right, mm-hmm. I'm going to just try to play one of his songs, and started singing it, and it just sort of felt right in my mouth, you know.
Yeah.
And recorded it and then gave it to my manager. I said, I don't know what you want to do with this, but you know,
here's something.
Let's give, if there's any money, let's just give it to charity. You know? So that's what we did.
I love that. How did you find getting a song from an artist that you're very aware of and influenced by into your own? Or getting your own voice into it. It's tough with songs you're familiar with. You know the way that they do it, and you don't want to just imitate that. You need to do it your way, but that can be the hardest thing.
That's a great question. That's a great question. It's always the question for me when I do a cover, and I have done, you know, a handful of cover songs throughout my life and career. And for me, the trick is to pick a song by listening to the songs, but not really thinking about how it sounds,
right?
But more thinking about the lyrics and how you relate to the lyrics. So like, you know, just thinking like, okay, how does this relate to my life? Like, is it something that I can say out of my own mouth and feels natural?
Yeah.
You know, and then as far as how it sounds, I just try to definitely not listen to the song again once I start working on it.
Yeah.
And just sort of let it evolve naturally through the process of playing it a bunch of times, and then go production wise, go where it wants to go at that point.
Yeah.
Totally disregarding the original artist's recording.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
So kind of learn to forget.
Learn to forget how they said it.
Yeah.
And say their words from my where I stand.
Yeah, I love that finding the connection lyrically, so that you can find your own emotional attachment.
Exactly.
So I'm doing an acting class at the moment, because I moved into acting a few years ago, and the thing I'm loving about it is it's all about finding these memories and these emotional connections. So even though you're playing a character who's not you, who's very different from you, it's finding those things of, right, I can connect that. So when you look in my eyes, you can see that I'm talking about this person, and I know who they are. I know what's there. And I think that comes across in a cover. You can tell if you're trying to imitate the emotion in the original, or if you're putting your own true emotions into it and finding that link.
I love that. I love it. Have you done stuff?
Yeah. So I stopped doing music to go into acting like 3-4 years ago, and I've done a BBC show, an FX show. I've got a film coming out soon.
Amazing.
And I love it, and it's exciting, but it's also exciting that being new to it and being fresh. And it was that weird thing, because the first load of roles I got because I'm not a drama school kid.
Meaning what? Because you didn't... You weren't polished or feel like the traits.
Yeah. One of the first things I did was a show called The Bastard Executioner on FX in America. And it's set in England. It's all medieval. And they said, 90% of the editions were very much, and now come to my, and I just went in and did it as me, but with their words. Yeah. And they were like, that's it, that's what we want. But equally, I'm a perfectionist and a nerd on these things. I love TV and films. So it's like, I don't want to just turn up and play me every day.
Yeah.
I want to learn the right things, not the wrong things and not the cheesy, hammy things. Learn the right things that I can improve. But the reason it came to mind was so much of it is learning to forget. I'm learning all this stuff and then going, right, part of that I want to forget because I don't want to be inside my whole head the whole time. It's the same with performing. There'll be certain things that you do on one night live and you're like, oh, that was great. And then you'll start to force it a few nights in a row and then it won't be great anymore because you're too inside your own head that at this moment you do that slight turn or whatever else it is. It's like, it's not great anymore. So it's finding what caused you to do that. So it's learning the mechanics of it and then trying to forget it. So it's just there and it's a natural thing. And that's what kind of, obsessing over at the moment.
I love that. You know, I've been thinking about doing a acting class.
Yeah.
My girlfriend went to school for acting for a little while. She switched over to something else, but I think it would be fun.
It's fascinating, man.
I love what you're saying about it.
If you find the right one, but then equally, I think all learning is about testing your own beliefs and convictions anyway. So even if it's a bad acting class, I think you can go there and go, no, I think that's bullshit.
Yeah.
But at least you've questioned it. At least you've tried it and gone, yeah, I see what you're saying with that, but I don't need to pretend to be a tree for half an hour. Right. I'm not a tree. It's all right. It doesn't have to happen. But yeah, I think all of those things are interesting. And the more you can find things in your life that are going to push you and are going to scare you as well. Again, that's the thing. I did a tweet the other day because I was literally going to bed and there's a few different scripts I've written that are starting to get some traction. And I've been fighting so hard to get them made, I've not thought about the idea of actually making them and how fucking scary that is. And I had this moment of, oh, what if they actually option it and I've got to now make that? That's terrifying. I don't know if I can do that.
This is what happened. This is Trump running for office.
Yeah, exactly that. The excitement of then and going, I've got to do this now. It's the same with Brexit as well. It's why we keep pushing for new elections, I think. It's because everyone who gets in there goes, oh, fuck, I can't do this.
Right.
Let's have an election. I'll get voted out and it'll be someone else's job. I think we're going to have endless elections until someone goes, should we just call it a day? I don't know.
So what happens if you do? But I mean, it's exciting because if one gets optioned, then it's going to be, I mean, you'll find your way. You just it'll be just like, all right, here we go now.
It's like everything. I think with music, I'd quit my I'd recorded a record and quit my job to tour the country with it, and it was on the first day I had to do, I was doing it all on street corners, the first one, that's the first time it crossed my mind, I was like, I've never performed live before. I've made this record, I've quit my job, I've made this my only option.
And you're doing it alone in your room.
That's it, exactly. Yeah. I've been rapping in my room, that's where I connected on that first bit. I was like, I've been getting it all tight. Oh, hang on, I've just thrown everything away for this that I don't know if I can do yet.
Right.
But again, I think that whole, if you've got something to fall back on, you're more likely to fall back, is valid. So it's that, but that doesn't make it any less scary.
So
when you keep throwing yourselves into these situations again.
So with that said, on your next development, how did you know, okay, it's time to stop making music and just go full-fledged into acting? Like,
well, for me, it's weird. I was talking to Brent, your tour manager, about this just now, because it was that I'd realised that with music, I quit working in a record store and I said I'll give myself a year to try and make music work, because if I'm not doing it full time, I don't think I'm trying properly. It'll always be this side thing, or I'll always tell myself it's my main thing and my job's the side thing, but the job's the thing I'm getting up at 7 o'clock every morning for, and so on and so forth. So I quit and did that, and it worked. Almost a year to the day, me and Dan Lesac released a song called Thou Shalt Always Kill, and it got in the charts over here, and it was like, right, I'm doing this now. This is scary, but I'm doing this now. And shortly after that, we had a song called The Beat That My Heart Skipped, which Gel remixed as the beat that my gel flipped. So again, so we had, this was all happening. And it was a similar thing there. I'd been wanting to do acting for a long while, and I'd started the podcast, weirdly, and a few of the people I'd had on were friends who were actors and stuff like that. And they were all saying, so when are you just going to start doing acting? Because anytime we meet up, I'd be nerding over this film or their performance in this role and all this. And it was exactly that. I kind of, as I was saying to Brent, we'd got to this point where I'd enjoyed every gig I'd ever done, but I could sense round the corner it was going to start to become a chore. Mm-hmm. It was going to start to become, oh, fuck, we've got another tour. All right, let's go and do it. So I was like, right, let's stop now and try again, try for a year. And then in that first year, I got cast in a Guy Ritchie film. Ended up being edited out of it, so I never made the final cut. Yeah. But I still spent 2 months on set learning, getting a taste for it. And, yeah, it's been sad and lovely to realise I've not missed touring at all.
Yeah.
Like, when POS has come over, I've got to go and watch his show, and at no point, and we've done tracks together, so it could easily be I'll jump up and I release his record on my label over here, so again the crowd would be excited if I jumped up and did a track, but I had no desire. And same with Sage and B. Dolan and all this kind of thing.
You won't even get up and do a track.
Nah, it doesn't, there's no,
they've asked you and you'll be like, nah, I don't,
yeah, know. Yeah, but part of that is I think there's a control freak element in me. So at the moment, my last album was my biggest commercially, the tour was the biggest, and our last gig was at a festival called Bestival. We had like 10,000 people there. They all knew it was our last gig. We were introduced by Rob DeBank, who runs the label,
yeah,
who signed us. How can I knock that off the pedestal of my last gig?
That's perfect.
I've gone out on an absolute high there, and you don't get to do that. Again, it's that awareness that you don't get to do that shit often. Yeah. So it's kind of going, right, why would I do another gig and have that as my... Because, again, your last gig is always going to come at some point.
Yeah.
It's an inevitability.
Yep.
So at the moment, I've been able to choose that. And, yeah, I'm reluctant to knock that off. But, yeah, Dolan and Sage and all that lot in particular, particularly Dolan, are always like, just do another record. Just do this, or come up and do this, or just do it. And I'm like,
so you haven't, and you haven't recorded either?
No. I kind of, again, it sounds like it's some great level of restraint, but equally, I did a lot with a guy called the Dan Lesac, who I love, but I feel we did 3 records. I like that where it is. A kind of similar to a Cloud Dead thing, where what happened, mm-hmm, to go back to it might feel weird, or at this point anyway. So I've not got producers knocking my door down or anything, so it's quite easy to go. I still scribble away some raps every now and then and stuff like that, but yeah, it's been easy to just go, all right, that's that. But I'm working on scripts and all sorts of other things like that, so that's where the excitement is. And as we said,
if you're still writing, you know,
if you're trying to live your life as an artist rather than as a commodity, then you have to go where the excitement is. So although all of these scripts have hit walls or haven't happened or are slow or whatever, that's the thing I'm going to be thinking of. Oh, I can make that happen in the story.
Yeah, you're following your instincts as an artist rather than,
rather than, I know that there's,
I know I can make $1,000 for playing at this show. Exactly. I just keep doing that. Like, blah, blah.
There's money on the table, but I'd rather walk away with my winnings than go and get involved with what's left. But,
yeah.
So what's that? I'll kind of wrap things up now as we're coming to the end of our time. What's ahead for you? You've just had your record out this year, and I said you've toured, you've had the 10-year anniversary earlier in the year. What's ahead? Is there more new music? Is there more anniversaries coming up? What's the plan?
You know, you've caught me at a weird time where I have to say I don't exactly know. Like, things, you know, I have like two things on the pipeline. You know, I have an EP that I have to finish before February 1st. Sort of a collaboration thing.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm allowed to talk about it right now.
Fine.
So I have that, and then I'm working on someone else's album. I'm producing someone else's album just after that. And then after about May or June 2020, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I don't know.
Is that exciting or scary?
Both.
Or both.
It's both. It's both. Yeah. Like, yeah, part of me feels like, because I, like you, I don't want to be a commodity. I don't want to be have to be on Instagram like, please come to this show, or you know, listen, look at me, listen to this new thing. Yeah. Listen. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's unavoidable to some extent, but
it's tough because it can make you start to resent people as well, because you're having to beg people to come to shows, and that feels shit on
your part. Or make people resent me for being an asshole on social media. Or not an asshole, but just constantly. So I don't know. I am excited to see what the new chapter is for me, you know, because I feel far from done as an artist.
Yeah.
But I feel like the page is turning somehow.
Yeah,
you know,
I think it's exciting to pause at times, or important to pause at times, because again, as soon as you're in the loop, you are in that album tour,
it's and it so just hard becomes a loop that. That
you've got booking agents or people who put or promoters say, are you going to be over again this year? And you just, it becomes a loop, and that can still be a wonderfully artistic place. And you guys are always people who I feel have kept that excitement and the artistic notion there. But again, at some point, you're going to question, is this
what my life
because
it's what
I'm trying to do, or because that's what I know that's the next step, that's what I have to do.
Yep, exactly. At some point,
you're making your dinners every 3 days.
Exactly.
That's what's happening. Happen in music coming. You're like, here we go, I'm preparing for the next one, then I'm preparing for that at this point.
Exactly. At some point, you have to question and say, okay, is this what I'm on earth to do? Like, you know, I have one life. How should I live it?
Yeah.
What's important for me to do or say? Yeah. And I don't know that it's that, you know, like, I think that I feel very proud of that chapter, you know, like I feel like I've made good work and I've played some good shows, and unfortunately I don't have a 10,000 capacity show to end my career on, but, you know, we can let it fizzle in Copenhagen with a sold out 200 people, maybe.
Again, you know? On all these things, it's weird choices, isn't it? Because that was a thing that we announced, it was our last show, so we made a big deal. There's another thing I won't mention now that I'm thinking of bringing to an end, but I don't want to announce it. I don't want to make a big deal. I want it to just be over. I don't want to have... Part of it is I don't want to put some weird pressure on this. Mm-hmm. This is the last time we're doing this. It's like, there we go. I've been proud of it every time we've done it.
Yeah.
I don't want to make it seem as if this last one is special because it's the last one. The last 10 were special.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? All of them are special. So it's that weird... It's a weird balance on these things, I guess.
Absolutely. And I also feel... You know, I don't feel maybe as cut and dry as you do about it. Like, I feel like, you know, like, if it makes sense to go do a show, I'll do it. And if, like, you know, maybe we'll set up some cool special occasion stuff where it is more, I mean, intimate vibes or whatever, and do something a little different here and there. Cool. You know, like, I don't think I'm done writing songs. I just think that, you know, I'm just sort of figuring out how I change it up to make it still feel like, okay, this feels fresh and new, and I'm saying what I want to say and doing what I feel is natural.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure, and I'm glad we got a chance to sit down and have this conversation.
Absolutely, man. I am very grateful that you asked, and it's been a delight.
Thank you very much, sir.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. I really enjoyed that conversation. I hope you did too. We could have gone for hours. I mean, we went for over an hour. We were creeping towards the 2-hour mark, but we had to wrap things up. I hope you enjoyed that. As said, speechdevelopmentrecords.com is where you can get all your Christmas goodness. I'll see you next week with Disgraceful Drunk Car Shame. Cheers, guys. Ta-ta!
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.